Welcome back. In my last talk, I discussed the origins and development in the first millennium BC of the Chinese writing system, the appearance and archaeological discovery of the oracle bones, especially at the last Shang capital of Yinzhu, and the sorts of things that the oracle bones tell us about the functioning of the Shang court, and also the things that they don't tell us, by comparison to Mesopotamia, for example. I will note that the use of oracle bones continued into later times, although this was gradually replaced, the scapulomancy and plastromancy that I spoke about last time, these ways of seeking knowledge of the future, were gradually replaced by other forms of divination, especially those associated with the I Ching, the Book of Changes. According to historical sources, in the middle of the 11th century BC, the last ruler of Shang was defeated in battle by the king of Zhou, a neighboring state. The Zhou dynasty would last, at least in theory, until 256 BC. That is, for almost 800 years. Although, for the last four centuries of that period, the reign of the Zhou kings was more or less entirely ceremonial. According to later histories, the Zhou defeat of Shang was due to the immorality and cruelty of the last Shang king, who was, confusingly enough, known as Zhou Shang. We'll never know if this is an accurate portrayal of this last Shang king, or perhaps more likely, later political propaganda. The historicity, the historical reality of the Shang itself was similarly uncertain until archaeological research uncovered Yinzhu and eventually other Shang capitals and urban centers from the 1920s onwards. This research, and especially the discovery of the oracle bone texts, provides us with a fascinating perspective on the development of theories of political rule in China during the Shang and Zhou periods, and where this was seen as a way of understanding how rulers should behave, what the function of rule was, what the rationale for central authority and kingly rule was, and how the king related to the nobility and common people. Archaeological investigations of Shang urban centers, like Yinzhu, provide us with rather different perspectives on the Shang state from those given by the histories. In fairly striking ways, to some degree. On the one hand, the deaths of Shang rulers involved human sacrifice on a scale equaled by few other early states. This was, in fact, human sacrifice on an extremely large scale. If we compare human sacrifice during the Shang period to the other areas that we've mentioned, or the other areas that we will look at in later lectures, well, what do we see? We see that perhaps the scale of death associated with the demise of a ruler in Shang China is equaled in some instances in Mesoamerica, in the New World. Perhaps, for example, at the royal graves at Ur, but in most other parts of the world, in Egypt, for example, although we do see some instances of human sacrifice on the death of a ruler, the numbers are not nearly as great. The practice of human sacrifice on the burial of a ruler would not persist in later times in China. And the parallel to practices in early dynastic Ur and in Nakata and during the first dynasty in Egypt are actually quite striking. There is this fascinating pattern of human sacrifice at the beginnings of states, and then the disappearance of the practice, no doubt to the significant relief of those people who would be in line to be sacrificed, as states become more established. And it may be that close to the origins of ancient states, the place of the supreme ruler, the status of the supreme ruler, is precarious. After all, why would common people, or particularly other members of the nobility, necessarily want to give up their autonomy to the king? Why would they want to recognize this individual as special, as having different rights and powers than anyone else? This may be, as I noted, particularly a way for the ruler to distinguish himself from other members of the elite. Under such circumstances, ending the lives of retainers, slaves, prisoners, perhaps even in some cases family members, at the death of the ruler, would provide a striking claim that the ruler was in fact different from everyone else, different in kind, in quality. In later times, after the state became more stable and the status of the ruler more or less unquestioned, such practices could lapse. One interesting parallel, in this case between Egypt and China, is the habit of burying images of servants and retainers in graves. Not the actual people, but in this case images, statues. In Egypt, these were known as ushabti or shoabti. In China, for example, we have the example of the famous terracotta army of Emperor Jin Shi Huang in 210 BC. Here we have a model of one of the soldiers in the terracotta army. It's significantly smaller than the actual terracotta figurines, which are on average over 6 feet tall, and which are modeled personally after different members of Emperor Jin Shi Huang's royal guard. One of the most significant archaeological discoveries in the last 50 years has been the recovery of this vast mausoleum, if you like, of terracotta soldiers. It's unclear if, in either the Egyptian case or the Chinese case, there's any direct connections between the habit of burying figures of individuals in royal tombs with the earlier habits of human sacrifice, with statues standing in for real people. In Jin Shi Huang's actual tomb, it's said there were also the bodies of workmen who built it buried as well. It's unclear why, but in both cases, in both the Egyptian cases and the Chinese case, there seems to be a concern with provision of assistance to the ruler in the afterlife. One of the things I'll note is that the tomb of Jin Shi Huang is perhaps the greatest unexcavated archaeological site known today. Its location is well known. It's an artificial pyramid of earth, 350 meters or almost 1,100 feet on a side, and 76 meters or approximately 230 feet high. Its description in historical sources is well known. Sima Qian, I mentioned Sima Qian in an earlier lecture. I talked about him as the writer of a text in about 100 BC called the Shijie, the Records of the Grand Historian. Sima Qian talks about the tomb of Jin Shi Huang as a complete buried palace, with fantastically elaborate representations of the entire map of contemporary China, and indeed of the entire cosmos, reproduced in miniature, with rivers and seas filled with liquid mercury. And in fact, astonishingly enough, extremely high levels of mercury had been detected by remote sensing in the soil covering the tomb. So this may actually be true. At this point, and wisely, the steps that archaeologists have taken are not to excavate this tomb, but to preserve it. And in fact, I don't know many archaeologists who would feel comfortable about excavating a tomb so vital, so important in Chinese history, and at the same time so immense and complex, particularly if they're doing so in mercury-saturated soil. One question that we might ask ourselves about Shang human sacrifice would be, why were the numbers of sacrifices much greater in the Chinese case than in many other cases that we know? Is this simply because of larger populations in the Chinese case? There's a question there. At the same time as we think about the bloodiness of human sacrifice, the Oracle Bone divination texts yield a picture of the ruler more recognizable to later Chinese scholars, the Wang, the intermediary between earth and heaven, who assured the stability of the realm through sacrifices to the gods and ancestors, through his own initiatives, and even through, as I noted last time, the right kind of court music. This ritual especially involved the organization of feasts and sacrifices with food and especially meat served in bronze vessels, often tripod-shaped and often, as I noted last time, with inscriptions cast into them. Thus, this integrated set of activities of ritual and sacrifice is associated with particular forms of material culture, and particularly, especially, the bronze vessels that were found as far back as the early 2nd millennium BC at sites like Erlido, and also the oracle bone inscriptions, forms of material culture that show up in Shang archaeological contexts and that are always emphasized in the historical sources as well. As in many other early states, these activities and decisions, participation in these rites and sacrifices and ceremonies, these are personal activities associated only with the individual ruler. And it's very likely that many of them could not be delegated. To the extent that the Oracle Bone writings are almost exclusively concerned with the activities of the ruler, it appears that one central element in Shang rule was monopolization over linkages to the gods and ancestors. This seems to be absolutely central to our understanding of the rites and ceremonies associated with the Shang court and with the activities of the Shang king. Researchers often conceive of Shang rulers as essentially the chief magicians or shamans of the royal court, and thus of the state as a whole. This is a different way of thinking about leadership, about rule, but it makes a great deal of sense, and to a significant degree was probably also the case in many other areas of the world. We could see similar sorts of things happening, for example, in Egypt. As I noted, the identification between the pharaoh and the Nile and the Egyptian state would have been played out actively in rites and ceremonies. But in the Egyptian case, we do not, to the same extent, have historians in later periods writing descriptively about how those ceremonies worked. To some degree, this view of Shang kings as shamans and magicians conducting divination and sacrifice probably underestimates their secular preoccupations, because they were vitally involved in the secular world as well. However, it may be a fairly accurate representation of where Shang ritual power lay. We then have to ask how that ritual primacy, the role of Shang rulers as the chief magicians, the chief shamans, the chief diviners, might have been translated into political power. Perhaps it might be a better idea, though, to turn that question around. If, as seems likely from the archaeological record, lineage groups organized around descent from a common ancestor were important social institutions in China from at least Yang Shao times onward, so in times when we see fairly small-scale agricultural societies in China, then we can imagine that commoner and noble lineages would have used ritual ties with their own ancestors as conduits to the supernatural. Everyone has ancestors. It's not as if the Shang rulers were the only members of the society with ancestors, or perhaps is it? Come back to that in a moment. We've noted this relationship between living people and their ancestors as a common practice, going back almost certainly, I'd say, to Shetalhoyuk, and even before on other sites in different parts of the world, and still found in many areas of the world. The question then becomes, how did Shang rulers manage to gather into themselves, to some degree to monopolize for themselves, this basic ritual activity? What justification, what ideological manipulation gave their ancestors, the ancestors of the rulers, favorite access to the high gods? Why were their rulers so much more powerful than everybody else's? Now, once they become king, perhaps we can say, well, because they're the king. But if we think of this relationship to the ancestors as one of the factors that may have driven kingship, then we have to ask ourselves how the process started and why other people would agree to this. There's a real question here about how this justification would have began. And at this point, it's a question that we can't answer conclusively. What we can say, to some degree speculatively, a little speculatively, is that it may well have been related to control over especially fertile agricultural lands along the Huanghe River, in the area where the Shang urban centers eventually appeared. And this would be probably during the Longshan period. In an agrarian society, the relationship between agricultural success and the favor of the gods would be perfectly clear and vitally important. I will note that, for example, in the area of Cameroon that I work in today, an area where agriculture is difficult and a little precarious, that there's a very close relationship between agricultural success, magical ability, and the vagaries of particularly rainfall. Magical ability affects where rain will fall at the beginning of a growing season, and that may in and of itself, just a few rainstorms, may determine the success of that growing season. So this is a set of logics that I can understand very well. We may begin to get a sense of the ways in which the different aspects of kingly and noble behavior came together by looking at written accounts from some centuries after the end of the Shang period, during the Zhou period. These come from texts like the Zhou Xuan, the Chronicles of Zhou, compiled some centuries later, and what are known as the Spring and Autumn Annals. And these are really among the first written sources in China to have been produced as historical texts, although, of course, focusing entirely on the dealings of the nobility. And it is with the Zhou period that we get the true beginnings of a Chinese literary tradition beyond the oracle bone inscriptions, which are not, of course, were not written as literary texts. One question, of course, has to be, can we infer Shang ritual practice and Shang ideology from later Zhou texts? There seem to be enough parallels in the archaeological data, particularly between late Shang and the early and middle periods of the Zhou dynasty, to make that identification seem legitimate. But I will note that this probably does not say anything about earlier Shang times. We're now speaking of the very latter part of the first millennium BC. This period of the Zhou dynasty, in the middle part of the Zhou dynasty, when these texts were written, when these historical texts were written, it was a feudal period with segmentary systems of authority, where the households of nobles reproduced in miniature the structures and behaviors of the royal court. In this period, during the Zhou, the ruler was first among a set of noble equals. Society was highly stratified, with great social distance between commoners and nobility, and a complex system of distinguishing different grades of social rank, particularly among the nobility and at the royal court. Now note, in this, it resembles closely the information on Shang court organization that archaeologists have gained from the oracle bone text, as I noted in my last lecture. And it appears that the court functioned in similar ways in the late Shang and early and middle Zhou period. Perhaps with more centralization of authority during the Shang and early Zhou periods compared to the more feudal times of the middle Zhou dynasty. During the 8th and 7th centuries BC, the two great political activities of the state, of the ruler and of the nobility, were first, sacrifice, and second, warfare. These two activities of the ruler and of the nobility were linked together by the killing of sacrificed animals, and more broadly by the pattern taking of life in order to make contact with the ancestors and the gods, and to feed the ancestors and the gods both meat and honor. As Mark Edward Lewis, who's written on violence in early China, speaking precisely about this period, has said, "The noble was above all a warrior and a sacrificer, a man who took life in order to feed the spirits who gave him power." From our readings of the Shang oracle bone texts and from the archaeology as well, this would seem to be a good way of thinking of Shang nobility and the Shang ruler as well. Indeed, one contemporary way of distinguishing nobles from commoners was the designation of nobles as those who were concerned with ritual, who were concerned with rites and sacrifice. And this implies, again, that nobles had access to supernatural and ancestral power in ways that weren't really available to common people. So there seems to be a different sense of what it meant to have ancestors. For the ruler and the nobility, on the one hand, those people who could connect to ancestors in an active way through sacrifice and ritual, and common people who had ancestors in a biological sense, but not in the same active supernatural sense. Their ancestors were not in the same way people who could be invoked through ritual, who could be counted upon to help living people in the living world. A fairly profound difference. There are certainly isolated accounts of human sacrifice that occurred as part of this ideological system during the Zhou period. Human sacrifice didn't entirely go away with the Shang, although it does not seem to be any longer associated with the death of rulers during the Zhou period. Sacrifices, human sacrifices, were sometimes made to noble and royal ancestors, or in order to provide blood for the anointment of war drums. And in fact, Chinese kings were still attempting to ban the practice of human sacrifice by members of their nobility in the 4th century BC. So it persisted in these other sacrificial contexts for a long time. Closely associated with these two great activities of the nobility and the ruler, warfare and sacrifice, was hunting, which was seen both as a close analogy, indeed a direct substitute for warfare, and also as a way of producing animals for sacrifice. Indeed, it was seen as improper for a ruler or a member of the nobility to engage in a hunt except to practice for warfare or to capture animals for sacrifice. Hunting for food was the duty, was the job of commoners. At this time, bronze, in the early middle Zhou periods, bronze was still the only utilitarian metal in China. And, as in the Shang, it was used for essentially three things. Bronze was used to make the serving vessels used in sacrifices and feasts. It was used to make weapons. And it was used to make the tools needed for building chariots, which were the military vehicle of the nobility. Those were the three functions of bronze. During this period, political power was diffused through the nobility, and Zhou government needs to be thought of as a set of competing noble lineages with their dependents. Each of those noble lineages had its own ritual and sacrificial cycle analogous to that of the ruler, and the same ideas of honor and pride of place held in the nobility as well. Each noble lineage also had a dependent population that could be called on as levies for warfare, and the Zhou army, which hardly existed through most of this period, was in fact the combination of these different levies from different noble families within the Zhou state. Warfare during the Zhou period was diverse. It was undertaken against neighboring states, which are always dismissed as inferior and barbarian in Zhou texts, and which are little known archaeologically. It was undertaken as well against pastoralist populations in surrounding areas, particularly to the north and west. And indeed, conflict with pastoralists, the Xiongnu, probably related to the Huns, the Mongols, the Manchus, would be a theme in Chinese history for millennia after the Zhou period. And there was also a good deal of internal warfare between different lords and warfare undertaken by the king to keep the fractious territories of the state together. As I've noted, these accounts come from several centuries after the fall of the Shang, and particularly they don't account for the beginning of this ideology of rule, which must originate in the Xia and early Zhou period, and if not, very likely before that in Longshan. And they also do not account for what appears to be a successful monopolization of ritual power by Shang rulers. It's quite possible, of course, that significant resistance to this hegemony over ritual power by Shang rulers existed, even close to the capitals. But of course, this would not often feature in court texts. At the same time, these Zhou accounts do provide a fascinating insight into the ways in which Shang rulers and nobility may have conceived of their proper place in life and of the activities, the ceremonial and ritual activities required to maintain that place. We'll now very briefly examine some areas of Southeast Asia where state formation seems to have occurred as a fusion of indigenous, Chinese, and Indian cultural elements and ideologies. Thank you.